I'm looking at Judges chapter 4. I've got a number of readings. I apologise. They may be long, but I will be brief. So I'm just starting Judges chapter 4 and reading from chapter 4, verse 1. And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord when Ehud was dead. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, that reigned in Hazor, the captain of whose host was Sisera, which dwelt in Harosheth of the Gentiles. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. And Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lipdoth, she judged Israel at that time. And she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. And she sent and called Barak, the son of Abinoam, out of Kadesh Naphtali, and said unto him, Hath not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, Go and draw toward Mount Tabor, and take with thee 10,000 men of the children of Naphtali and of the children of Zebulun, and I will draw unto thee to the river Kishon Sisera, the captain of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his multitude, and I will deliver him into thine hands. And Barak said unto her, If thou wilt go with me, then I will go, but if thou wilt not go with me, then I will not go. And she said, I will surely go with thee. Notwithstanding, the journey that thou takest shall not be for thine honour, for the Lord shall sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. And Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Verse 14, And Deborah said unto Barak, Up, for this is a day in which the Lord hath delivered Sisera into thy hand. Is not the Lord gone out before thee? So Barak went down from the Mount Tabor, and 10,000 men after him. And the Lord discomfited Sisera and all his chariots and all his host with the edge of the sword before Barak. And so Sisera lighted down off his chariot and fled away on his feet. Verse 22, And behold, Barak pursued Sisera. Jael came out to meet him and said to him, Come, and I will show thee the man whom thou seekest. And when she came into her tent, behold, Sisera lay dead, and the nail was in his temple, and God subdued on that day Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the children of Israel. And over into chapter 6, verse 1, And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens, which were in the mountains, and caves, and strongholds. And so it was, when Israel had sown, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, and they came up against them, and they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till thou comest unto Gaza, and left no sustenance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. And they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried unto the Lord, and it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried unto the Lord because of the Midianites, that the Lord sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, which said unto them, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and I brought you forth out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all that oppressed you, and drave them out from before you, and gave you their land. And I said unto you, I am the Lord your God, fear not the gods of the Amorites, or those of the land in which you dwell, but ye have not obeyed my voice. And there came an angel of the Lord, and sat under an oak, which is in Ophrah, that pertaineth unto Joash, and the Abzarite, and his son Gideon threshed wheat by the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him and said unto him, The Lord is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, If the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord hath forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. And the Lord looked upon him and said, go in thy might, thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? Verse 25, and it came to pass the same night that the Lord said unto him, take thy father's young bullock, even the second bullock, and seven years old, and throw down the altar of Baal that thy father hath, and cut down the grove that is by it, and build an altar unto the Lord thy God upon the top of this rock. Verse 33, and the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. And the Spirit of God came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and Abiezer was gathered after him. And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also gathered after him, and sent messengers unto Asher and to Zebulun and unto Naphtali. They came up to meet them. And Gideon said unto God, if thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and if it be dry upon all the earth besides, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast said. And just over chapter 7, verse 2, and the Lord said unto Gideon, the people that thou that are with thee are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Now therefore go to proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead, and there return to the people 22,000, and there remain 10,000. And the Lord said unto Gideon, the people are too many. Bring them down unto the waters, and I will try them for thee. And it shall be, of whom I say unto thee, this shall go with thee, and the same shall go with thee. And of whomsoever I say unto thee, this shall not go with thee, the same shall not go. And he brought them down. He brought the people unto the water, and the Lord said unto Gideon, every one that lappeth of the water with his tongue as a dog lappeth, him shalt thou set by himself, likewise every one that boweth down upon his knees to drink. And the number of them that lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, were 300 men, and all the rest of the people bowed down upon their knees to drink. And one final verse. In chapter 8, and the men of Israel said unto Gideon, verse 22, and the men of Israel said unto Gideon, rule thou over us, both thou and thy sons' sons also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of the Midianites. And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my sons rule over you, the Lord shall rule over you. I couldn't even begin to cover a fraction of perhaps that passage, but I just want to bring a few small thoughts. When I was first looking at sort of, you know, what to speak on, which is always kind of like a difficult thing when you're trying to think what to speak on, my thoughts had completely gone to speak upon the kings, and that's what I had in my mind. And as I looked at them, I kind of felt you can't really get your grip of the kings until you've understood the judges. And that's really what turned me to look at it. And I can't begin to say that I begin to understand the judges, but I've spent some time looking at it and just to pull a few thoughts from it, which hopefully will be helpful to us. So previously, we kind of looked at the first three judges, and we sort of saw then in that that the judges, the time of the judges, followed on from the time of coming into the land, and that the that Joshua had led them in, and that they'd seen great victory, and that he, that they'd pushed back the people, and that there was a time of great confidence, and the following on from that, that the what you saw was that there were little pockets all over where for different reasons where they felt well we won't just drive them out, we can just leave those few, those few of the Canaanites won't be any problem, that won't be any difficulty, and for different reasons as dotted around there were those who remained, and that's following on as we remembered that there were incursions from various nations round about, and that each time it would say that the Lord raised up a judge, and each time it would just seem that they were just there. There was an Othniel, and he was, when it was a Mesopotamians, he was on it, and he was able to go and lead the people to a victory. And then an Ehud, a man just so quietly, when there was a problem with the Moabites, he was there with his dagger. And it's just, it seems as though there's the call, and scarcely the man has gone, and he's there, and he's right into the heart, as it were, of the enemy territory, and right into the palace, and dealing with the problem. And a Shamgar who faced with the Philistines, he's there with his ox goad, and he's there, and he's defending Israel. And after the last time, I thought, okay, next time we'll start looking at the kings. But then I just read on a little way and just came to this man, Barak. And there we find a man who leaned heavily upon the faith of a woman. And, you know, it just struck me. This man who is kind of, there's almost not that much said about him, really. Although he occupies a few chapters, he kind of doesn't really appear very much. And we've moved into a time here where there's a king that has risen up within the land from the Canaanites. This character, Jabin. And if you'd read back in the book of Joshua, you'd read about a Jabin who ruled in Hazor. And Joshua had defeated him. And he destroyed him. And he'd neutralized, as it were, his military assets, which were formidable. For he had chariots. And strangely, many, many years later, we find springing up in Israel, in the same place, with the same name, the same formidable foe seems to have resurrected. And here he's with all his power. And he's taking and he's controlling the people. And you would think as you start to read, that there doesn't seem to be an answer to it. And that the one who is identified as the judge in Israel in that day is this woman Deborah, who is beneath the palm tree, who the people go to, but who is going to deliver the nation in that day. And it's Deborah that calls Barak. And he comes. And with these two judges, we find two men who it seems that they're gonna need a bit of persuasion and a bit of a push. And it's not like the Lord has called and they're there. No, there's a reticence here. And we find a man and he comes and Deborah puts before him, and you would get the impression what she said that it may be the Lord had already called him, but perhaps he just hadn't come. and she calls him, and she says to him, puts before him the need, and the need that's for someone to call the people. And what is his answer? I'll go if you come with me. And amazing, he says, yeah, I'll come with you. And when it's time to summon the people and to blow the trumpet, as Deborah says, now's the time. Now's the time. Now's the time to call the people. And it would just seem that here's a man, and in his appreciation of God, he's relying on someone else. And just as simply as I just read that for the first time, I just thought, in all my life, perhaps there's been so much time when I've really depended on someone else. And sometimes that can just become the point which you start to really doubt the strength of what you really have. And to see, and as I looked further at that, to see that this man, although he needed so much support in the spiritual guidance, that he still appears in the roll call of faith in the book of Hebrews. And of all that, and although you'd have thought the writer might have started with an Othniel, or he might have commenced with an Ehud, as he works his way through, he starts with a Gideon, and then amazingly, Barak. And he finds his name there amongst the great men of faith. And although we don't know a lot about him, we find him there. And so as we look at the book of Judges, and we look at these men, so often we associate this book with those words, and so often when people talk about Judges, they will always say that the words which we find three times in this book, there was no king in Israel, and every man did that which was right in his own eyes. But I would just ask you to remember that those words do not come until about chapter 17. And that is not describing a situation that should have been, or perhaps even a situation that should ever have come to pass. As we go through, so we start to look at these men, and we consider the pathway of this book, and we would brought before us is that this is a book that tells us something of the ways of God. And as we've thought of the people as they were brought out of Egypt, and as they were brought through the Red Sea and through the wilderness, and as God led the way by the pillar and the cloud, and as he brought them out, and as he brings them in, and he brings them into the land, the thing which they should have known was that there was a king in Israel, and that the God who had brought them in was the God who wanted to lead that nation. A king is the face of the nation. The priest represents to God. The king represents to those around about the face of the nation. And this nation was not without a king. God didn't give them an earthly king, because they had a heavenly king. And as he brings them in, and as he gives them his words, and he gives them their law, for them, not like the nations round about, for these people, the rules, the way that life was to be conducted, that was to be in their hearts. There was no, in a sense, we think of the law as being terribly difficult, and yet in a sense it was terribly easy. The parameters of life were set out very simply. And so for the man in his everyday life, as he goes about his business, as he sees something which, and if it ever crosses his mind to take that which is not his, he has it there, simply, thou shalt not steal. All he has to do is think, yes, the words that God gave me, that he asked me to put in my heart, to meditate upon, to bind on my arm so it affects my actions, to bind on my head so it affects my thinking. All he had to do, faced with that, was think, no, that's not right. And if he succumbed, and if he was not able to overcome, there was an offering that he could bring for forgiveness when it struck his heart that he'd done wrong. And as you could work through, as it was to affect their moral life, the thou shalt not commit adultery. For the man, as he goes about his everyday life, as he sees that which would then tempt his heart, there to think, in my the Lord has given me in my heart and asked me to think and to meditate upon his law, which would tell me that this is wrong. And more than that, as we stood upon the mountains, apologize, Gerizim and Ebal. And as we've pronounced the blessings, he has told us, he has showed us that to follow these words are the words of life. These are the things that our blessings depend upon. That it's in the, that it, this is a moral world. This world is based upon moral principles. That in following God's moral principles, from this will flow a nation that is happy, a nation that is provided for, a nation that is able to go up to Jerusalem every year and to know that it's secure, because the nations round about will know that this isn't God's nation. And so for the people of Israel in that day, for them was a tremendous opportunity to just hold, to just do what God said. And you say, well, that would just seem a very easy thing to do. But of course, because it isn't. Because the heart is so dark. The heart is so dark. And that even with a panoply of the tremendous good things that God had promised and had laid out that they could receive so easily, that at the first turn of the road, they have bowed down and they are worshipping Baal. And you say, well, no, that's an amazing thing. Well, we know our own hearts, of course, we know it's not an amazing thing at all. And so they've been there, been not in the land so very, very, you know, they've been a number of years. They've seen. And as Gideon, as the angel speaks to him, and he looks back and he says, well, yeah, we remember that there were times when God moved and worked, and he doesn't seem to be doing anything anymore. And now as all this has come upon us, and and we're, and by the time we get to Gideon, we're absolutely overrun. And this isn't just an army. This is just hordes of the Midianites just pouring in, and the land is just impoverished. They're just coming in, and they're just grazing the crops. They're just en masse, obliterating everything, and every good thing is just gone, and there's nothing we can do about it. And Gideon says, "Well, remember, there was a time when God worked, and we knew, but he's just, there's nothing anymore." And it's all going downhill, and it's all poverty, a loss. And God comes and speaks to him. And of course, the first thing he has to do is he draws his attention to that in his own back garden, every day, he's walking past an image of Baal. And they've lost sight of God. And if Deborah comes to Balak, or under the palm tree, there's an angel that's going to speak to Gideon. and he's under an oak. And it's that which is long-lasting and stable. And the angel comes with a message that God is going to work. And Gideon is a remarkable character, really, when you think that a man who just realized that he was small, that he's nothing, that he really wasn't anything he could do, that he's down, and that there's just feels that God's not working and that it's pretty hopeless, and that God's going to show him. And you know how many signs God gives him. First one, he asks him to make the offering, doesn't he? And the angel puts a rod on the rock and it's burnt. And as he would prompt him to call the armies together, and there's so much. And Gideon asked for the fleece. And God would make the fleece wet and the ground dry, and the fleece dry and the ground wet. And as the arms are coming together, and God would just whittle them down to just a handful. And the man who's looking for signs from God, God will show him that when he's going to work, and when God's going to work, it's not going to be anything to do with the prowess or the army of Israel at all. It's just going to be the mighty hand of God. And it's just 300 men against a multitude that is almost unimaginable. And he's just still able to do that. And so we find, as we come through, I mean, it just runs us right through to that point at the end of, towards the end of Gideon's life. And the people say, after all of that, the people say to him, how about you be our king and your sons be our king? And at that point, Gideon is able to tell them, and he's learned enough of God to be able to tell them there, I'm not reigning over you. The Lord shall rule over you. That's the answer. That's what you need. It's the Lord you need. You don't need a man. You don't need a king. In Deuteronomy, they're told that one day the people will want a king, because they'll see them all around. But it'll be from the people. What these people need, they need God. They need God to rule over them. And up to, through the lives of these men, to bring the people back to understand that the thing that they missed, and the thing that they need, is that the God of heaven should rule in their affairs and be the guide and the light of their nation. And did they ever know it? They never truly knew it. And we might go through the times of the kings, and it was always waiting for one person. It was always waiting for one person, the true king, to come. And when he came, sadly, they still missed it. Still missed it. And you wonder in the ways of God, how is it that through so many different ways and so many different times that mankind has been allowed to miss the most important thing? And he missed it in Eden. And he's missed it ever since. And the thing that God has always looked for was a honest and willing heart to accept what God was and what he gave. And man had the freedom to choose in Eden, even in that perfect situation, and he chose wrong. And as a principle, it would just seem a principle that has worked down through every age, that God has made things right, that man could go right, that he could realize, and always he misses it. And in every dispensation, he's given the opportunity to choose. It's never been a dictatorship imposed. And so when Satan comes before God in Job, and he says to God, and God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" What Satan would really seem to be saying is, "Now hang on a minute, you're not following your own principles here. You're influencing Job in a way that you don't do. You are guiding his decision making here in the way you're treating him." And God would show him, "No, that's not the case at all." But that would seem to be what Satan is trying to say. And so that the ways of God with man are wonderful. And when Satan got man to fall, he must have thought, "Well, look, this is completely hopeless now." Because God will not make men believe. He will not make men right. So the situation is completely hopeless, and man's lost. He's never of his own choice. He failed in Eden. He will never ever choose to trust God now, because that's completely beyond any possibility. But never to reckon with the cross. That in the work of salvation, it became possible for sinners to be saved and to know God. Sinners who couldn't choose God, sinners who couldn't make a right decision, in the work of Christ, to turn to that man upon the cross and realize that the God who was offended, the God to whom we owed everything, is the God who's above and all beyond that has paid the vast immense price that wretched blind sinners can know him, the God. And that one day there'll be a heaven made up of people who are there because they have chosen, and of their own free will have chosen the way of salvation, and that they freely want to know God, and that he has made it possible in the tremendous work of Calvary. And so as we look at the judges, we see a day when God was the ruler and they didn't know it. And as we go through our lives, he's the king of our life. How much do we know of it? How much are we really like the people, and we kind of oblivious and insensitive to what he would show us, to what he is, to all that he's, to all that could be ours, and to miss out, and perhaps almost to be like Gideon, and be in our hearts to be saying, "Well, we know he worked in the past, but there's nothing really happening now." And to miss the fact that maybe it's just the hardness of our hearts, and we could be just missing out on blessings which he would freely give. Shall we pray? Our gracious God.